The sun is rising on a clean energy age.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Good morning, the Sustainable Hour podcast listeners. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're on stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was and always will be First Nations land. In nurturing their land and their communities as they have for millennia before their land was stolen, the Wathaurong people have accumulated a great amount of ancient wisdom. And it's this ancient wisdom that we're going to need as we work our way through the climate crisis.
In the middle of a climate crisis, the Albanese government has just approved the North West Shelf extension to 2070, a climate bomb that will be directly and can be attributed to increasing heat waves and sea level rise, a climate bomb that Australians will pay for many times over as our homes are lost to floods and inundation and our communities impacted by extreme heat. There is a direct causal relationship that is increasingly able to be scientifically tracked between fossil fuel majors like Woodside and the cascading climate impacts that all Australians will feel in the years and decades to come. Woodside has already caused 49 heatwaves. How many more will it contribute to under the 3-degree scenario released under the climate risk assessment that expects mortality to rise by 444% in Sydney by 2090?
Annika Reynolds there, ACF's National Climate Policy Advisor, speaking, and I would say speaking well, in the Senate last week. After this climate risk assessment report had just been released about the storms and the bushfires and the flash flooding and sea level rise that is coming our way, and which will, of course, influence our house insurance and our economy, cost of living and the rest. And then the day after, the government released its new 10-year target about how much we're going to cut down on our climate pollution in the next decade. So it was a big week for climate activists and for climate in general here in Australia last week. And there's been a lot of discussions ever since about whether the glass is half full or half empty, depending on how you look at things. Are we or are we not doing something sensible now about this escalating climate crisis? I think really what the government is saying indirectly with this new target is that it's going to be up to all of us. It's the business community and it's the Australian people who will have to step in if we want to show that we are going to be more ambitious. The government is still pointing out a direction. Right now, for instance, we have reached 40% of green electricity in the electricity grid, which is great. And we are heading for, according to the government, more than doubling that in the next 5 years. So we'll reach 80% of green, clean electricity in the grid by 2030. And if we want that to go faster and further, we can, of course, do our bit, which 4 million homeowners already have done, getting solar up on their own roof and on their company's roof and so on. And in my opinion, that's why the glass is half full, because we know that 80% of this population here in Australia are very much on board and saying, yes, we can do more. And now the ball is beginning to start rolling. It's all happening now. So I think from an Australian perspective, the glass is half full at the moment. But what about the rest of the world? That's where we bring in Colin Mockett, OAM, who's got the Sustainable Hour's global overview, which I am assuming, Colin, that you are going to deliver to us as you always do right now. And so what does, in your opinion, the global glass look like now, Colin? Is it full or is it empty?
Well, my research this week has come up very heavily looking at the Australian perspective, and it's half empty. But it's different experts that you speak to. But my roundup this week begins in Geneva in Switzerland, where the World Meteorological Organization released its latest set of figures. They began with a series of record-breaking global temperatures, which confirmed what they'd already announced, that 2024 was the hottest year on record. It beat the previous hottest year, which was 2023. But what's more important is that their current figures and their computer modeling forecast that there is now an 80% chance of future years surpassing, starting from this year. This means, in brief, that the world's temperature is continuing to rise, despite the best efforts of science and some 50 years of the UN's collective endeavours. The WMO data shows that without any doubt, global warming is driven by increasing greenhouse gas levels, leads to worsening extreme weather events, accelerating sea level rise and record ocean warming. And that leads us to the Australian experience, where last week we saw our nation on a climate roller coaster ride. It began with the Prime Minister returning from the Pacific Islands Leaders Forum, which was putting together its submissions for the upcoming COP30, which is coming up in Brazil next month. Now, remember, they represent the most endangered nations on Earth because of their vulnerability to sea level rise. But on the day that Anthony Albanese returned, his environmental minister approved exactly what those leaders feared most. With the announcement that Mick's already told you about, he approved Australia's gas being exported and burned for another 45 years. That will certainly have been noticed by our neighbouring nations. And then a day later, Climate and Energy Minister Chris Bowen belatedly released Australia's climate risk assessment, which turned out to be a damning report forecasting high to beyond severe risks for every one of Australia's key systems by the year 2050. Then on Thursday, the whole team came together to announce Australia's 2035 target for domestic emissions. And this was aimed at 62 to 70% emissions reduction. And it was almost certainly influenced, if not written, by Canberra's rich and powerful fossil fuel lobby. Like all of Australia's governments since Julia Gillard's, the new policy did not put a price on carbon, and it didn't stop or do anything to reduce or even tax mining or logging. But most of all, it didn't even acknowledge that there is an elephant in the room, and that's the sheer amount of fossil fuels that our nation cheaply exports every day to be burned by other nations and adding vast and largely unmeasured quantities to the total global emissions. Instead, behind Australia's 62 to 70% reduction target are dodgy accounting figures and greenwashing announcements like carbon capture techniques that would allow our fossil fuel and mining industries to continue pretty much as before, while the government announces wacky million-dollar schemes that don't address any of the central issues. The response from Australia's climate scientist from Friday onwards was immediate and savage. "It's worse than I feared," said Bill Hare. He's a founder of the Policy Institute Climate and Analytics. He said that a 2035 target of at least 76% was necessary if Australia was to align with the global goal of holding warming close to 1.5 degrees. It's baffling that in the same week the government could release a terrifying document warning Australians of a grim future if global warming continues, and then turns around and agrees to a target that, if all others followed, it would lead to a warming of 2 degrees, he said. Australian Maritime Conservation Society Chief Paul Gamlin went on record after the announcement saying that since the large land masses heat faster than global average because of lower sea temperatures, Australia is currently warming faster than the global average. While the lower Paris target is 1.5 degrees, Australia has already hit that level. So now, should the world warm to 2 degrees, the Australian landmass is likely to hit 3 degrees, he said, unleashing the floods, fires and disasters that climate change brings. That's why it's so often said that Australia has more to lose from runaway climate change and considerably more to gain from ambitious climate action, he added. But it appears that there is no voice in Canberra advising our government of this, or if there is, it's being effectively drowned by the roaring fossil fuel lobby. And just to add an extra level of bad news for our nation this week, and contrasting our recent programs about tiny homes, a paper was released by Domain Real Estate, and it's called Sustainability in Property Report. It says that Australians are currently building the biggest homes in the world. Some of these homes have only 1.1 persons in them, and they are huge. We also buy the biggest cars, thanks to government tax incentives, making SUVs or light commercial vehicles the top-selling cars in Australia, despite them being the biggest polluters. And further to this, with our addiction to consumerism, we have the unenviable reputation of being the biggest purchasers per capita of fast fashion in the world. And in this regard, we overtook the United States and the United Kingdom to take first place. We buy between 80 and 90 items per person per year, and that's creating a waste crisis for ourselves. Finally, off to somebody else. This is Europe, and for the first time in memory, Europe will be going to the COP without an organised, preordained measure. That's because there is, at the moment, confusion in Europe, because a couple of nations with right-wing governments are refusing to sign on to a climate agreement. And those nations are led by Hungary and Italy. So they're not unified at the moment on climate change, where they have been all the time since Ursula von der Leyen began leading the European community. So there's confusion in Europe, and there's, what can we say? There is depression in Australia, thanks to our government too. So it's time. I'm pleased to be able to finish this week with the news that the world's greenest sports club, Forest Green Rovers, beat Woking 2-0 away at Woking at the weekend, and that leaves them clear on top of England's fifth division. And I do hope I've got better news for you next week, Mick.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Ramandeep Sibiya. Ramandeep is the founder of Punjabis for Climate. She's also a certified host for the Warm Data Lab. Okay, Raman, so there's a couple of things to look at there. Maybe tell us your story and how Punjabis for Climate came about, as well as your contact with the Warm Data Laboratory.
Thank you so much for inviting me today. I would like to thanks to you, Tony, and to your team. So Punjabis for Climate was started by myself and another guy from Canada. So interestingly, there was a guy from Canada who was running a radio show in Melbourne in Punjabi language, and that show was called A Podcast on Climate Change. And I found it really interesting that somebody is doing this from Canada, and we don't have a person in Australia who could do something like this for Australian Punjabi speaking audience. So I spoke to him over the phone. He was very generous, and we actually really sounded quite close to what we wanted to do, and you know, how could I join him? And initially also, like, if he could mentor me, because I never had run the conversation or the climate talks or anything like that in Punjabi before, but he was doing this for a number of years. So we start working together, and then we thought we have a website, or we call ourselves like a name. So we named it Punjabis for Climate to start with. So this is how it came into existence, a group for multicultural Punjabi people living in Australia, but not just here in Australia, a global group, and a group for Canada and India. So that's how it became. But at that time, I was also working with another environment organization in Melbourne, and I was volunteering for and in touch with a couple more organizations. So I was going about hosting stalls and other, conversations in the libraries and stuff like that. And I start noticing that there was something off and there was something missing. There was something which was not adding up. So I could not put my finger on what exactly it is. I know four languages. So partly when I was switching my language, all of a sudden I was noticing that there is something. There is something going on, but I couldn't put my finger. And when I was listening to Nora, I was wondering, I start making connections. So there is something which she talks about and she knows. So I need to go and train with her. So I went to Adelaide when she was in Adelaide early this year to train with her. And so since then, a lot has been unfolding for me from my own observations, from switching the language and all that. And so, and that's the main area of my work now, that the why the climate conversations are so confusing and what it is about them, which are creating problems for the movement itself. Perhaps we can talk more on some of those stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe to begin with, just so we have everyone with us here, speaking about Punjabi, that's a large language group, both in India and Pakistan, right? So maybe first explain to us what Punjabi actually means.
Yeah, so Punjab was a big geographical area in the India when it was colonized. And when British left India, so Punjab state was divided between these two countries, Pakistan and India. So India has a very small portion of the state Punjab, but Pakistan has a large portion. It is a state where five rivers flow. So that's why that's named Punjab, which means five rivers. So it's a beautiful, fertile land in the north of India. And the Punjabi is a language which is 5,000-year-old language, and more than that, perhaps, from what we know so far. And there, it's the fifth. It's among the five most spoken languages in Australia itself. Yeah.
So it's United Punjabis. This group aims to unite Punjabis around the globe who are concerned around climate, the climate crisis we're facing.
Yeah, so I would say about the ecological crisis. So we see it differently. So we see it the, you know, I call it to bring back the relationships. So how can we restore the relationships with the nature, with land, with air, with water, and with the communities? So that's how we see it. It doesn't matter that we are using the word climate or not, eventually the work will be happening. And then, and the way I see it is from a very different angle, from the angle of relationships. So there has been a guy called Bhagat Kabirji from 17th century in Punjab. He has written these two beautiful lines that पोथी पर जग मुआ पंडित भयो न कोए ढाई अखर प्रेम का पढ़े जो पंडित होए. So it meant that no matter how many books or degrees you do or how much you study, you cannot rise until you understand, you feel the two and a half letters of love. So love has like four letters in English, but when we write it in Punjabi, it's prem, it's two and a half letters. So until you know the two and a half letters of love. And what is love? Love is relationships, yeah? So this, we live in this entangled world, which is not made up of data or individual things. It is made up of in relationships. So until we understand and restore those relationships with community, with land, with water, with air, with the nature. Basically, that's how we see it. That's our job, to restore the relationships. And that's the basis of the work that we're doing.
So how is that done? What do you do to start that journey for people?
Yeah, so for example, last week I was in Sydney with one of the other girl, Manjot and Sukhdeep. We three people organized there is a coal mine in Mullarbun that is up for, extension for another 10 years. And that will mean that the next nature reserve next to it, the forest will be cleared to make that happen. And then we organized an event. Manjot created a documentary and I emceed the event. And Sukhdeep, who is a pop singer, who has won a number of awards in Australia for his song Mother, which is a Mother Earth song. So he was with us and he in the end sang a song for people. So we had this gathering which we fully facilitated in Punjabi. We discussed that we need to, what is our collective responsibility here, and we will be meeting again in a few weeks when the submissions will be open to write the submissions to the our local and the federal MP over there. Yeah. So that's the one of the examples, yeah.
What have been the impacts, if any, on Punjab physically from the climate crisis?
Okay, so there is a little bit of a trick. So when we talk about the climate conversations, I try to keep this, like, you know, the mainstream way of seeing the crisis is very different. So when we see that, you know, CO2 in the atmosphere is a problem, I don't see it that way, because the CO2 in the atmosphere did not come from somewhere in the space that everything we were doing on the earth was totally fine and then suddenly CO2 came. CO2 came as a byproduct, as a consequence of, you know, something that we are doing. So if we go back and take the example of this coal mine, so first, worldwide, this is the pattern. First, we clear the forest to mine, and then we spoil the land, we spoil the forest, and then we kill the animals and we displace them. And then anything that is extracted from the land, either it is coal or gas or oil, we always need to clean it. And then in order to clean it, we are spoiling the rivers and then the biodiversity that lives in the rivers, the life. And then eventually this is transported there, which is again a lot of extraction, lots of roads are built, infrastructure is built, and then it is burnt. And then it eventually goes to the air. So we cannot just point to the air that the crisis starts there. And so when, if people ask me, so recently we had really devastating floods in Pakistan and India in northern areas, and Punjab in both the countries suffered immensely. So if people tell, talk in a way that climate change is causing these floods, that is very misleading to say that, because it is not that the climate change is causing it. Climate change is the consequence, it's not the cause. You know, it's very important to distinguish that. Climate change is the consequence, it is not the cause. It cannot cause anything. So climate change did not go to Uttarakhand and did the deforestation in the Uttarakhand, the north of India. It's not a thing, you know, it's a name. Name is not a thing. So the way we talk about this, that the floods in the North India or the India and Pakistan, that region, that devastating floods are the interplay of these shifting global conditions, the climate conditions and the deforestation in the local areas, the dams mismanagement, the mismanagement of the rivers, and, you know, the urbanization and lots of other factors. So it's an interplay. So the local vulnerabilities play a great amount of role in any sort of crisis. It's very misleading to say that climate change is causing this, climate change is causing that. I think this language itself is logically incorrect, because when we talk about this, we try to be very, very clear to portray climate change as a consequence, and the cause is actually the a whole lot of exploitation that we are doing as the name of modernity and for the name of, you know, development. So we need to question that. We need to question our way of living. And then I also do not use the words like mitigation or you know, adaptation, because I feel like these words are too abstract. We again created these nouns when all the talk we could already do in the verbs, keeping it down at the base level, logical levels. So this is why we say we need to restore our relationships with the communities, land, water, air, and nature, and rebuild. And that's it. And this is exactly the thing that I was noticing, because I know these four languages, and then when I go to other languages, these words do not exist, and we are talking in verbs and not using these nouns, and everything is simple, everything makes so much more sense, you know. And when we come back to English, it's like, holy shit, of these abstractions that we use. It's the abstractions and nouns and these logical errors, you know. And then we sometimes it's like totally mess up. We don't know what is a cause, what is a consequence, what is a symptom. So this is why I have now started a series of the blogs on this topic, where I'm showing this as a very, very small chunks is what I'm noticing. And that series is called 2.5 Letters of Love. So that's the name of it, yeah.
That's really interesting, Ramandeep. We had a guest, Joseph Gelfer from the United Kingdom, in August. He runs an organization called Our Fair Future. And he talks a lot about, just like you're saying, changing our language. That people in the climate action movement actually should stop talking about climate and instead begin talking about what people are interested in out there. And like you say, relationships, our relationship to nature, that's a big one. But also the fact that creating a pollution-free society is actually possible. It's something we just need to shift our mind towards that, don't we? That if we don't want any more damage to this planet, we will have to stop polluting it.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally possible. So even if we take the example, you know, when people say that this extra CO2 in the atmosphere is creating global warming, I would say, how? You know, I would say how? Because if we look at that, how is Earth maintaining its temperature? It needs everything. It needs the healthy rivers, healthy forests, healthy land, and healthy air. So that's the balance to restore the temperature comes from the relationships between the land, air, and water, and oceans, and all of that, and forests. You know, if all of a sudden today we make some big giant device that will absorb the atmospheric carbon dioxide, and if we keep still doing the same thing that we are doing on the Earth, will we be out of the crisis? Of course, no. Because actually we are among the multiple existential crises, and CO2 is the consequence again. So this is a major part of the work that we are doing, that to clarifying the conversations and bringing it back to the root causes. And I remind myself a punchline. So there are some punchlines in Punjabi that we keep using in our houses and villages. We call them akhans, and one of the akhan is, it's called, you know, chor nu na phado odi nani nu phado, like don't try to catch the thief, catch its maternal grandmom. Like get to the root cause, you know, get to the root cause. It just remind us that don't get stuck on what you're seeing. See where it's coming from. So one of the things that we keep doing is keep bringing back to the root causes and talking it clearly. So I want to take an example of, like, when I get fever, it's not that my body's temperature rise. So what happens is I can't breathe properly, I can't eat properly because I don't feel hungry, my digestive system struggles, my heart beats faster, I can't be happy. So a lot of stuff keep going. So when our planet is warming, it's giving us lots of symptoms in the form of floods and fires and, you know, all of that. So those are symptoms, like our body does. So because everything is interconnected. So because when the air is warm, the ocean current changes, and then the whole air current changes, the seasons change, the rain change. So everything is interconnected. And that balance is somewhere in between, in the liminal space between the relationships between everything that our planet is made of. So that's how I see that. Yeah.
Health authorities are warning Australians to stay out of the heat today as temperatures climb yet again after heat records were broken yesterday. Australia's ongoing heat wave has been pushing temperatures to almost 50 degrees Celsius.
Hush now, little one. The night feels long. The world outside can seem so wrong. But here by my side, you're safe and warm. Love still matters, yes, even more. You grow your roots around the storm. You're not in meant to face this all alone. The stars shine. Can you hear they sing? Even through despair, you'll find your wings. I feel the weight, I see the storm. I do my best to still keep us warm. The clouds are dark, the water's cold. I carry you both, the young and the old. I grow my roots around the stone. And I'm not meant to face this all alone. The stars shine, I can hear them sing. Even through despair, I'll find my wings. It's okay to cry, to feel afraid. This hurt we feel means we're still awake. But don't build your home in the pain you find. Let love and hold your mind. We'll grow our roots around the stone. When I'm meant to face this all alone, the stars shine, we can hear them sing. Even through despair, we'll find our way. So close your eyes, my precious one. The fight's not over, and we're not done. It's a broken system, but we still belong.
Last week, since the government released first this risk assessment plan and then a plan for how much pollution it's going to reduce, the target of 62% to 70% reduction in the next 10 years. Ever since, there's been so many figures flying in the air between people. Some are upset about the word net zero and some are on the barricades both for and against this net zero idea. And it's all, as you say, a bit abstract, I think, to most people who don't really understand what is the net when we talk about zero carbon. Why isn't it just zero carbon? Why is it net zero carbon and so on? And we don't really talk about the consequences of not reaching the zero carbon, of not drawing down carbon from the atmosphere, which is that there are plants and animals and people dying, literally dying as a consequence of us not stopping this madness and allowing big companies to do all sorts of damage to, as you say, not just to the air, but also to our land. And we've been doing this, if we're honest, for more than a century now. So I think you're right, Ramandeep, that we are not talking about the real thing. We're only talking about some very abstract figures and numbers and so on. And I think really we missed the point. What is this all about? It's about protecting life, our safety, our security, and these kind of things.
Yeah, because of a lot of these abstractions and the way we are using the language, we don't do this in lots of indigenous languages. And I can move between four languages. I can see that very, very clearly. And then this thing, actually your body pushes you. And it's not just me. Lots of other people who know other languages, their body just push them. And I start connecting the dots that this is connected to, that, you know, the movement has become a lot like a meeting, you know. It's like a lot, and you go to another climate event and it's the same number, same faces, same people coming back next time, you know, the new people are not showing up, the general anxiety among the public is growing. So that the point of that anxiety that's growing, because these abstract singular cause level statements are exactly the similar structured statements that the mental health patients are usually stuck with, because I'm also a neuro-linguistic programming master practitioner, and the way I explored in that field, lots of people who are struggling with mental health issues, they are not struggling with something, the real ground stuff. A lot of times they are stuck in the abstractions. They feel like something, you know, XYZ abstraction is holding me to act in life, you know, stuff like that. And similar statements, if we are giving to people, and that climate change is harming you, climate change is causing blah blah blah, we are giving them the structures of anxiety. We are serving them that. And as a people who work in the movement, it becomes our responsibility to pause and reflect, to see what we are saying. And then if we just stop using a lot of abstractions, then a lot of people will start joining the movement, because it will feel like it includes them. Right now it feels like too heavy, too abstract, doesn't make any sense. What is my role in that? And it's not just the climate change movement. The same story applies to cost of living crisis. When as a migrant, I came to Australia 10 years ago, nobody talked to what is the root cause of the cost of living crisis. They keep using up in the abstractions. And then how do migrants know what is the problem with the system, and they fight for the system's change? Because nobody is talking about that. They're just talking about some really high level, some abstract words. And then recently somebody said democracy is dying. I was like, okay, this is another one. keep joining this, you know, this way of talking about everything, you know. It is so abstract. Can we talk about the root level stuff, the very, very basics? And then a lot of people will start joining in. So perhaps I think that's where we need to pause and reflect. And then we also need to start looking at the relationships, not just the numbers, because they can't tell us the whole story.
We are talking to Ramandeep Sepia from Punjabis for Climate. And Ramandeep, what would then be your advice to our listeners, the listener out there who has heard your story and actually agrees with you? What would then be the next step for this person? What should we do, for instance, here in Geelong? Should we start up a similar-minded organization here, or should we join yours? And should it be around language? Like, should I focus on my Danish language background and try and open conversations with Danish people here in Geelong, or what would you recommend? How do we do it?
So it's I think we need to first be ready to pause for a little bit and be ready to explore what we are doing and what is happening, because that's very related. And in terms of language, it's possible to talk in plain language using the verbs and not going up in the abstractions. So I'm writing a whole blog series to that. We can put the link and if people want to subscribe. But I'm even happy to form like small groups and we sit down together and we learn from each other and discuss. That could be one way. The other way could be the warm data labs. So if we sit down and, you know, and do these warm data labs together, the question and the context in a warm data lab are created in a way that, you know, it will build up for us. So that is another a really beautiful structured way that Nora has created that will help us see the interconnectedness, the relationships, and notice the stuff with the abstractions and all of that and multiple descriptions and all of that. I think what we need is a lot of warm data labs and sit down and learn with each other. Yeah.
What's in that name? Warm data labs. Why warm?
So, because it the cold data is only about the data that usually. So, basically, the word abstraction itself, if we see, so there is some reality. There is some reality that is that we see in the world. If we don't put any words to it, it is what it is. Yeah. As soon as we put the first word to it, that what is happening or what it is. That is the first level of abstraction that we have created. Because if I think a pig in my head, the pig in my head is not the same pig on the ground, you know, because it's the abstraction, yeah? So that's the first instant of creating abstraction. So cold data is one which removes all the relationships. For example, mango. Mango is the stories of my, you know, grandmother. We had a tree. We used to sit, eat together. It has so many memories and all of that. But if I say mango is only 50 calories and this much sugar and this much carbs, that is not warm data now. That's cold data. That's just the numbers. So that's just the obsession with the data only and splitting all relationships away. But the warm data is keeping this data, but also bringing in the relationships.
And that's a key word, isn't it? Relationships. You started saying that, and we are ending on that note as well. What does relationship mean in this context?
So if we see, we usually say the animals depend upon the plants. We often say that. But if we look at the way birds, they poop the seeds and then the new trees grows and the butterflies and bees and, you know, all these different insects and even the birds itself, they pollinate. And then we can clearly see that these insects and birds and bees, they are the part of the reproductive system of the plants. And then the mycelium is part of the digestive system of the plants. And then we can clearly see that the plants itself depend upon the creatures, the animals. As much as the horse depends upon the grass also depends upon the horse. So there is no one-way relationships. It's entangled. We live in an entangled world. And until we realize that, different relationships, we can't respect those relationships and we can't even restore them. So it's, I think, very, very important. So I would like to say that there are like trillions of microbiota who live in and on my body. And without them, I cannot be me. And the part that makes me human, maybe is that those cells are maybe only 10% of my body. And rest all, my air comes from the environment, you know, my food comes from the environment. And the unit of survival, it can never be a creator on its own. It's always a creator and its environment, because all the food, all the breath, all the water comes from the environment. So that's the interconnectedness and the relationships, the way I see them.
They said it was the common, but the roots of our pride. chasing symptoms. They're chasing the flame. They resist to call the cause by its name.
Get to the root cause, you know, get to the root cause. See where it's coming from. There are like trillions of microbiome who live in and on my body. And without them, I cannot be me.
I'm weaving gently into those threads of life with awe and admiration, making new relations.
All the food, all the breath, all the water comes from the environment. So that's the interconnectedness and the relationships that the way I see them.
More people support climate action than you probably think. There's this perception that climate activists are in the minority, but this is so not the case. According to data from the People's Climate Vote, which is carried out in association with the University of Oxford, 80% of people worldwide want their country to do more about climate change. That includes 80% of Americans believing that countries should work together to combat climate change in spite of their other differences. In the UK, 90% of people believe that. Perhaps because 69% of people around the world say that climate change already impacts their big life decisions, like where they're going to move or what they buy. And this isn't something wishy-washy. People know what they want. 72% of people worldwide want their country to move to clean energy quickly. This isn't a fringe movement. The majority of people around the world know that climate change is real, know that it is a threat, and know that their country needs to do something about it by moving away from fossil fuels. The challenge, of course, is turning that sentiment into meaningful political action.
That's all we managed to fit into this particular climate and language-focused sustainable hour, very much about language. The way we maybe need to change even calling ourselves climate activists into something that's less about climate and more about or the normal things out there, such as nature and health and cost of living and so on. That's a really important discussion that we have opened up today in the Sustainable Hour. And we'll be following up on that next week, where I'm going to present to you one of the interviews I did while I was in Denmark last month. Among others, I spoke with a Danish author. He's very famous in Denmark, not so much here in Australia, but he's somebody worth listening to, I think, a real thinker and a science communicator called Tor Nørretranders. And together with him, I'll be exploring what it means to act in service to life on Earth, as we've been talking about ever since we had this interview with Joseph Gelfer back in August. The interesting thing about Tor is that he has just turned 70, and he's got this idea. So he published a book about it, which he calls The Elders' Revolt or The Elders' Reckoning, seeing elders as change makers and bringing, I think, some great inspiration for if there's anyone listening out there who is in that age group from 70 and above. Listen in again next week, Wednesday, 11 o'clock here on 94.7 The Pulse. What are we going to be, Tony, Colin? I would say we're going to be optimistic after you were in your gloomy mood today, Colin, a little bit with the news from around the world. But I think still that we can say that the glass is half full. I do believe that people and businesses here in Australia are going to take over where the politicians have failed us.
Well, I like the idea of your Danish author for next week and his call for a seniors' revolution. I mean, I'm all for that. I'm against all for seniors walking down the middle of the street with their fists in the air and their Zimmer frames. So you have nothing to lose but your pensions.
So be the difference. Be revolutionary.
Yeah, be aware.
Be belonging. Be involved. Be engaged. All of us.
Be it all.
Looking at your face right now, as you scroll through the headlines, I see the worry in your eyes about the world we leave behind. And I know you wonder if anyone will make it right. But baby, let me tell you something that keeps me up at night. There's still time to change the way things are going day by day. And when you feel like giving up, remember what I say. I can be that difference. I can be that change. Used to be clear skies and clean waters. It's hard to believe, but I'm not just sitting here waiting for a miracle. Got my friends beside me now, we're making it possible. Every small step counts, they say. Little changes pay for. When it seems too much to bear, listen close. I swear I can be that difference. Oh, I can be that change.
Yesterday's report is a breath of fresh air, but in some sense there wasn't much that's new in there, just a lot more detail about what's been known for a long time. I will only focus on a few key things, but let me start by reading a very important part of the report that might have been missed. Economic impacts of climate change, including the impacts on households and the cost of living. The emerging academic view is that the current modelling methodologies are likely to significantly underestimate the economic impacts and do not take into account the potential cascading impacts from the physical damage from climate change to our economy. Transmission of financial risk internationally could also significantly increase the economic impact. So what you see in that report is the best case scenario. My PhD is in macroeconomic modelling. I know as well as anyone the limitations of economic modelling. I assure you that the economic models we use, that Treasury use, that the Reserve Bank use, were not built with this in mind. And I can't stress enough the number of variables that are simply just not included in this model, because these models weren't built to do this. So this is a minimum cost. This is a minimum cost. Let me give you an example of how much worse things are than you might likely expect. A lot of people talk about insurance becoming unaffordable. Just to be crystal clear, every mortgage contract in Australia obliges the holder of the mortgage to have insurance. Every mortgage contract. The reason we think bank lending is safe is that they're not only lending against real estate, they're lending against insured real estate. So the entire risk profile of the entire financial system is based on the idea that house prices don't go down. And even if houses burst into flames, it's actually the insurance company's risk, not the bank's risk. So to be crystal clear, if a house is uninsurable, it is unmortgageable. If a house is uninsurable, it is unmortgageable. The potential catastrophic impacts of whole suburbs and regions not being able to insure their houses is not included in this report, rightly, because the tools for doing so don't exist. But again, to be crystal clear, the bank expects that if you've got a mortgage, your house is fully insured. If your house is not fully insured, you are in breach of your mortgage contract. Right now in Australia today, we know there are people who are uninsured. Right now in Australia today, we know there are people who are underinsured. The RBA isn't looking, APRA isn't looking, ASIC aren't looking. Everybody knows that not only is there uninsurance and underinsurance today, what this has just told us is that in the coming decades, there will be far more of this. This is a crucial part of the problem that our regulators are ignoring and that this report can't have provided the answers to. Just quickly, when this damage comes, someone will have to pay. You can only insure against unlikely events. Insurance companies do not insure against likely events. No 20-year-old in Australia can rent a Ferrari and insure it. Okay? No, you can't insure against that risk. What this report says is that flooding will be so common in large parts of Australia, you will not be able to insure. So just to be clear, individuals will not insure their way out of this crisis. You cannot insure against likely events. So what is going to happen is we are either going to tell people you are on your own, you are stranded, your house is worthless, we're sad for you, or we are going to say, oh, I'm so sad that we actually want to give you large amounts of public money. But to do what? To rebuild in the place that keeps flooding? To move? To where? These are not hypothetical, and to give everyone a sense of timing, we're telling 20-year-olds today to worry about a mortgage that they won't pay off before 2050. We're telling 20-year-olds to worry about superannuation that they won't get their hands on until 2065. And this report is saying there are catastrophic risks coming right now, way before you need your super, way before you'll pay off a 25 or 30-year loan. So the fossil fuel industry seems to me to be the obvious person to pay for this, because in Australia today we're giving half of our gas away for free. The ACTU says that if we taxed it at 25%, we could have $12 billion a year. We're giving more than $10 billion a year in Commonwealth subsidies for fossil fuels. That's $25 billion a year, that we could actually stop encouraging climate change with and start diverting. But to be clear, the insurance industry will not help people in 20 years' time with their flooded houses. They can't. That's not insurance. And just finally, we've done a lot of work at the Australian Institute on climate risk. Less than 40% of Australians even know what it is, what the term means. We are bombarded with information about superannuation risk. We are bombarded with information about what suburb to buy a house in to maximise capital gain. Most Australians aren't even in this conversation yet. Yet here we are, literally approving new gas and coal projects in the week leading up to this risk assessment coming out. No wonder the public aren't in uproar. Hopefully they'll read this report, but I can see why the report wasn't released before that most recent fossil fuel project was approved. But Australians need to engage with climate risk as much, if not more, than they do about superannuation risk or the risk of missing out on a cheap house. Thank you.